Members, I will now call the Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Subcommittee to order. Andrea, please call the roll. Here.
Vice Chair Belford. Ranking Member Tan.
Here.
Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Bell.
Here.
Representative Burfield.
Here.
Representative Frost.
Here.
Representative Dunkley.
Here.
Representative Escamani.
Here.
Representative Esposito.
Here.
Representative Gonzalez Pittman. Representative Henson. Representative Lopez.
Here.
Representative Lucentia.
Here.
Representative Redman.
Here.
Representative Schoeff is excused. Representative Temple.
Here.
Thank you, Andrea. Members, by your presence, we have a quorum. Members, I'll ask you all to silence your cell phones, please. And if there are any members of the public that wish to speak or provide testimony to the subcommittee, please fill out an appearance card. Good morning and happy 2024 session, everyone. This is our first meeting of the 2024 session. Members, today we will have one bill on the agenda, which is HB 7007. And then we also will receive an update from the Chancellor and staff of the State University System on the implementation of recently passed legislations. Our presenters today are Mr. Ray Rodriguez, who is the Chancellor of the State University System, and Ms. Emily Sykes, Interim Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, State University System. Okay, Representative Griffiths, you're recognized to present HB 7007.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair, and Ranking Member. We appreciate the time this morning. This is an open government sunset review. And by act of the legislature, every 5 years, we have to review these public record exemptions. This is the open government sunset review for the campus emergency response. This bill saves and repeal the public records and public meeting exemptions for a campus emergency response of a public post-secondary educational institution. This bill also removes an unnecessary provision of the exemption that specifies how the information may be shared, and that is the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Members, are there any questions on the bill? Representative Redman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this forward. I was just curious as to when the sunset date was supposed to be on this.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we don't, it repeals in October.
Any further questions, members? Okay, we will now move into public testimony. Is there anyone from the public that wishes to speak on the bill? Okay, seeing none, members, we will move into debate. Are there any members that wish to debate the bill? Representative Redman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Griffiths, I appreciate you staying on top of things like this. The reason I asked the question is because anytime you do a public records exemption, it has to include a sunset date. And unfortunately, sometimes those sunset dates, they get neglected. People don't realize them. They come and go without people even noticing. I had that happen last year, actually, with a bill of mine. We used to have a public records exemption for military service members and their families. Unfortunately, that was allowed to sunset. I think a lot of people didn't even realize it. So thank you for staying on top of this. And you know I'll be voting up for your bill. And again, it's crucial that we stay on top of these public records exemptions.
Thank you. Any other members wishing to debate? Okay, seeing no members wishing to debate, Representative Griffiths, you are recognized to close on your bill.
Wave close.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Griffiths, having closed, will Andrea, Administrative Assistant, please call the roll?
Representative Amnesty?
Yes.
Representative Beltran?
Yes.
Burfield?
Yes.
Yes.
Dunkley?
Yes.
Escamani?
Yes.
Esposito?
Yes.
Gonzalez Pittman?
Yes.
Henson? Lopez?
Yes.
Yes.
Redmond?
Yes.
Schoaf? Tingit?
Yes.
Temple?
Yes.
Chair Mello?
Yes. Members, by your vote, HB 7007 is reported favorably.
Thank
Congratulations.
You, Thank you.
Chair Mello?
Yes.
I was not called to vote. My name wasn't called, but I'm in favor of it.
Representative Bell. Okay. It's okay. Thank you.
Just for the record, thank you.
Okay, members, we are cooking this morning. Moving along, we are going to move on to our presenters. Mr. Ray Rodriguez, who is the Chancellor of the State University System. Good morning and welcome. And welcome, Ms. Emily Sykes, as well. Members, I just want to remind you that this is going to be an update on legislation that has been passed previously. Keep in mind that the Chancellor and the Vice Chancellor are part of the oversight, so be mindful of that. I would like everyone to wait until after the presentation for questions, but I just want you all to be mindful of that. You're recognized. Good morning.
Thank you, Chair Mello. And let me begin by saying that over the previous 10 sessions prior to the last session, I served in the legislature either in the House or the Senate and saw all the higher education bills, often carried those higher education bills. And I want to begin by acknowledging that last session was the most productive session in terms of higher education policy that we've seen in the last 12 years. And as the Policy Committee for Higher Education, this committee is the tip of the spear in terms of higher education policy. So you led the way on that. And many of those policies, not only did they pass and get signed by the governor, but we've seen other states who have looked at what's happened in Florida and chosen to implement or file bills to implement that same policy in their states. So once again, Florida leads and the rest of the nation follows. So I congratulate you on that. You've asked me to appear today to give you an update on a number of those bills that were passed last session, and I am pleased to do that. I can tell you since sine die last May, our team at the Board of Governors and our universities have been working very hard to implement the bills that you had passed and that the governor has signed into law, and I'm pleased to provide this update today. Oops. There we go. So as an overview, these are the bills that the committee requested an update on. We will go through each of those bills and address the subject area that the committee's requested a progress report on. The first one we'll address is Senate Bill 737, which was Purple Star Campuses. During the 2023 session, the legislature established the Collegiate Purple Star Campus Program, allowing educational institutions to be designated as military-friendly after meeting specific criteria. In November, the board amended our regulation on military and veteran students to outline the criteria institutions must meet to receive the Purple Star Campus designation, along with the process to do so. The requirements make designating a staff member as a military liaison and offering professional development and training opportunities for staff on issues relating to military students. The way our process works after a bill has passed and been signed into law and becomes a statute is that the staff at the Board of Governors will look and see if it's self-executing or if it requires direction to the universities. If it requires direction, our job then is to prepare a regulation that codifies your statute into our policy that then goes to the university to tell them how to implement that policy. That's a two-step process because you're going to see as we've gone through those steps on the rest of these bills. The first is we have to bring the recommendation to the Board of Governors. The Board of Governors will then hear the reason we brought it, in this case implementing a statute, and our recommendation on how to do that. They will either authorize us to proceed, and if they do, then the proposal we've done gets posted for public notice and we receive public comment for a set period of time. That's defined by our public records statutes. After the public record period has passed, we will then review the public comment to determine if there's anything that we missed in preparing the implementation proposal. And if there is, we'll go back and make a revision to the recommended regulation. If we do that at the next meeting, our report out to the Board of Governors is, based on public comment, we're going to recommend a revision. Here's our revision. If they authorize that, then we go back out to public comment again, receive public comment, and once the public comment period is passed, if we feel we have a regulation that addresses the intent of the legislature and the public concerns that have been brought forth, at the following meeting, we bring it to the Board of Governors for implementation. So you will see at least two meetings. The first is the notice where we bring it forward to say, here's our recommendation, and if the Board of Governors has authorized it after public comment, the implementation. Sometimes there's more than two based upon what we receive in public comment. So in this, we've gone through the process, and that bill has been implemented. We've developed an application template for state universities, and as of September of this year, that legislation exists in regulation and has been implemented by our institutions. We'll next move to the second bill. The next bill we've been asked to provide an update is credit for military combat medics. During last year's session, you passed Senate Bill 274, which expands opportunities for eligible current and former military combat medics to earn post-secondary credit or clock hours toward accredited nursing education programs. The new law allows for post-secondary credit or clock hours to be awarded for college-level training and education acquired while serving as a combat medic. This credit is to be awarded consistently across all Florida public post-secondary education institutions. The law directed the Articulation Coordinating Committee to convene a work group to develop a process for awarding post-secondary credit or career education clock hours. The work group recommended a policy and a process. Our board approved that in November. The board will consider an amendment to our military student regulation in January. We meet at the end of the month to recognize this policy and implement the provision into law. In the spring, the ACC will then recommend course equivalencies that will then be forwarded to our board for consideration. We believe that will occur in the June meeting. So the first part of the statute's been implemented and that the Articulation Coordinating Committee convened their work group and made their recommendations. We have that on our next agenda. Once we have passed that and made our amendment, the last step is for the Articulating Coordination Committee to then make the recommendation on course equivalencies. And when we receive that, most likely in June, that will then complete the implementation of the statute. The next bill we've been asked to provide an update on is Senate Bill 7026. In the section of this bill we've been asked to provide an update on is the university bonus plans. Senate Bill 7026 was signed by the governor in May, and it requires the universities to notify the Board of Governors annually regarding any bonuses provided to university employees. This statute's actually an update of a pre-existing statute which first authorized universities to come up with bonus plans for their universities. But that statute didn't contemplate having the universities report to the Board of Governors what those plans were or what had actually been awarded. So the legislature has come back, increased the accountability within our system by passing this provision in 7026 to require an annual reporting of that. In November, our board amended the regulation on university bonus plans to align with the statute, and the board staff will collect and compile the reports provided by the institutions as we go forward. The next legislation we've been asked to update is Senate Bill 846, Foreign Influence. Senate Bill 846 was signed into law by the governor in May and provides new requirements regarding grants, agreements, partnerships, and gifts between the state university system institutions and foreign countries of concern. Foreign countries of concern include China, Syria, Iran, Russia, North Korea, Cuba, and Venezuela. To implement these changes, the board amended our regulation on foreign influence in September of last year. The draft amendment was approved for public notice by the board at our June meeting, and then the final approval was made at the following meeting, which was on September 18th. The amendment to the regulation included adding definitions for agreements, foreign principles, and partnerships with such entities without Board of Governor approval, and prohibited an institution from soliciting or accepting a gift from a college or university based in a foreign country of concern. The revised regulation outlines the procedure for requesting approval and provides for sanctions if institutions fail to comply. Finally, it outlines reporting requirements for universities to provide relevant information to the board. The board office issued guidance to the universities regarding the new process to have the request approved by the board. This guidance was shared with all university administration in September of 2023, and so far the board has not received any requests from universities or any agreements to be approved. The next legislation is Senate Bill 783, Emergency Opioid Antigenist. This required the injectable opioid antigenist to be in all student residence halls and dormitories owned and operated by the universities, and for the Board of Governors to adopt a regulation administering the statutory requirement. The board developed a regulation on this in university housing, which is slated for consideration and approval at our January meeting, which will occur at the end of the month. This regulation aligns with the statute by requiring injectable opioid antigenists to be located in all student residence halls and dormitories owned or operated by state universities. The next bill we've been asked to provide an update on is Senate Bill 266, General Education and Core Course Options. We're going to have multiple slides on this bill because this was a substantial piece of legislation that includes multiple areas that the committee has requested a progress report on. To implement this provision in law, the State Board of Education and the Board of Governors together, I'm going to start with the general education provision, work together to appoint faculty to discipline committees to review the current general education core courses, content, and descriptions for compliance with the new law, which is sections 1007.25 and 1007.55 of the Florida statutes. These committees were appointed over the summer. They then met in August to discuss the requirements for core courses. The committees attended a face-to-face meeting in St. Petersburg on September 14th of 2023 to review the core course options and the draft recommendations for changes. The committees also reviewed and made changes to the course descriptions of the core courses and the proposed learning outcomes for the statewide course numbering system. The recommendations from the faculty committees were then published for public comment. The faculty committees reconvened in October to review the public comment and to finalize their recommendations. The Articulation Coordinating Committee approved the recommended list of general education core courses on October 13th. The Board of Governors revised the general education core course options at its November meeting. And at our January meeting, the board will consider the final adoption of our general education regulation changes to update the approved list of general education core courses and to fully align with the statute based on Senate Bill 266. We have worked very closely with our partners in the Florida College System and the Department of Education to implement this section of law to ensure consistency for students across both systems, the state university system and the Florida College System. We've done that because we want to make a seamless process as possible for students in the Florida College System who then choose to transfer into the state university system. The next phase of implementation will be to work with the universities to collect the general education course list. Statutes require that the Board of Governors receive the list from the universities by December 1, So the next one will be December 1, 2024, and then each year thereafter. The Board of Governors will approve or reject each institution's list of general education core courses using the criteria for general education course standards, principles, and content that are already in Florida statute. That statute's 1007.55. 1007.55. The next section of 266 will address is post-tenure review. Another part of 266 established requirements for hiring and personnel reviews. Our board amended its regulation on post-tenure review in November of last year, incorporated the changes to include the personnel actions, including evaluations, promotions, tenure, discipline, or termination, may not be appealed beyond the university president or designee. Additionally, universities must issue final decisions regarding personnel actions in writing and are not subject to arbitration. Finally, any grievance filing will not affect the university's action or decision, including the termination of pay or benefits for a suspended or a terminated faculty member. The next provision of Senate Bill 266 that we will address is diversity, equity, and inclusion. This provision prohibits universities and direct support organizations from expending any state or federal funds, regardless of source, to promote, support, or maintain any programs or campus activities that violate Section 1000.05 of the Florida statutes, or advocate for diversity, equity, and inclusion, or promote or engage in political or social activism, as defined by the rules of the State Board of Education and the regulations of the Board of Governors. Our office has been working very closely with the Department of Education to define together political and social activism as the statute requires us to, which would then allow the adoption of a regulation to implement these provisions. We have a proposed regulation to implement the prohibited expenditures provision. It's currently available on our website. Public comment on the regulation closed in late November. It is planned to come before the board for final consideration at our meeting later this month. And now, Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to allow my Vice Chancellor, Emily Sykes, to provide an update on the remaining bill and the two issues beyond that you've requested an update on.
Thank you, Chancellor. Ms. Sykes, you are recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Mello. Good morning. So over the last several years, the legislature has made changes directing the Board of Governors to consider specific data sources and timelines when identifying high-demand programs of emphasis. This started with legislation a few years ago that was passed to establish the REACH office within the governor's office and also the Credentials Review Committee to identify credentials and degrees of value in Florida. During the last session, Senate Bill 240 added language that required the board to use specific data sources in reviewing the programs of emphasis to ensure alignment with the work of the Credentials Review Committee. So I'm happy to report that in November, the Board of Governors approved a new methodology and list of programs of strategic emphasis that complies with all of the statutory requirements. While the board has identified academic programs with strategic significance for over 20 years, the programs on the recently approved list are more targeted and refined than any previous work. The methodology and lists were crafted to be data-driven to help meet Florida's most critical workforce shortages. The new list covers many fields such as healthcare, education, computer and information technology, engineering, and business. The list was developed alongside key stakeholders that included legislative staff, governor's office staff, business and industry, state agencies, and the university staff. It includes programs aligned with jobs needed to drive our state's economy forward. Programs like nursing, accounting, engineering, teaching are all included on the list since the list is designed to supply critical talent while supporting future anticipated economic growth in the state. The new and improved programs of strategic emphasis are important to the state, the universities, and our students, and the list identifies fields with significant workforce gaps and provides a tool to guide our institutions in delivering highly qualified talent needed in Florida for jobs with very high starting wages. The net effect is a win-win for all parties, since the list helps the board achieve its strategic goals, it provides planning tool for the universities, and it helps students select majors that result in a positive return on investment for their degrees. And this is just a high-level summary. There was a lot of detailed information and work that went into this, and it's available on our website, and we can also provide it to you if needed. Okay, so the second part of Senate Bill 240 was the Workforce Education Partnership Program. And this bill created this program. It's designed to assist students who enroll at state universities and are employed by a private employer participating in the program. The law required the board to adopt a regulation to administer the program and also create an application template for the universities to use. So the board adopted a new regulation administering this program in November, which it aligns with the statute and also outlines a process for institutions to establish a program. The board also developed and approved a required application template in September. And as part of the regulation, universities also have to provide an annual report on activities for each of the established programs that they have. Okay. I'm going to close the presentation with an update on two of the recent tuition waiver programs that the legislature established. So Section 100926 Florida Statutes requires the Board of Governors to select academic programs that allow eligible students to receive a program of strategic emphasis waiver. This waiver is often referred to as the BOGO waiver. It requires that for every eligible course in a qualifying program of strategic emphasis in which a student is enrolled, the state university must waive 100% of the tuition and fees for an equivalent course in the program. So this program started in June 2021, and the Board of Governors selected 8 STEM programs, and those are up here on the list. And in 2022, the legislature directed the board to select 2 programs in the critical workforce gap analysis, and the board selected accounting and finance, and so those were added in 2022. And then last session, the legislature asked the board to select 2 state-approved teacher preparation programs. And in June, the board selected elementary education and special education as the new education programs. And we use the information from the Department of Education in their rankings of identifying critical teacher shortage areas for the last year. That's a report that we commonly use to look at the teacher education programs that are in demand. So the waiver program has grown substantially over the past 3 years in terms of eligible students and the number and value of credit hours being waived and the number of eligible programs. Last spring of 2023, we had 16,000 students participate in this program. So the last waiver I wanted to give an update on is also a program that was established in 2021, and it's known as the Grandparent Waiver. And this waiver program began in the 2022-23 academic year, and it allows for non-resident students to be treated as residents for tuition purposes if their grandparents reside in Florida and the student meets eligibility criteria outlined in the statute. The legislation capped the number of waivers at 350 per year, and the board office allocates these waivers to the 12 universities in our system based on each school's relative enrollment and demand to maximize the waiver utilization. So the table on the slide details how the waivers have been allocated the last 2 years across the university system. And Madam Chair, this concludes my portion of the presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Sykes. Thank you, Chancellor, for your presentation. Are there any questions, members? Okay, Representative Burfield, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the questions I had was in reference to Senate Bill 7026, the University Bonus Plan process. Could you clarify, because I think I understood this to be the case, you took and modified the current process that they're using so that it's not a totally new process that they're having to go through or new documentation, or could you talk a little bit more about that?
Thank you. Chancellor, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. Previously, the legislature approved the state university systems to offer a bonus plan. I believe that occurred either in the 2021 session. Pretty sure it was the 2021 session. Prior to that, universities were not authorized to offer bonus plans at all. And so for 2022 and 2023, universities have had that authorization, and they've been, many of them, providing bonuses to employees. What the legislature had not asked for and directed us to do in the statute is to identify what are those bonus plans that are being awarded and how much is being awarded in bonuses. So the authorization to do bonuses existed previously. What that this bill 7026 does is it requires the Board of Governors to then get a report from each of the universities to identify what are their bonus plans, who are receiving bonuses, and how much are they receiving.
Do you have a follow-up? You're recognized.
So are those plans standardized, or do they come in all different shapes and forms?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair. It is not standardized. The statute has left that up to the universities. The statute that created the authorization left that up to the universities in terms of they decide for themselves what they wish to offer bonuses for. So it's not standard. It is up to the universities.
Follow up. And I guess I may not be making myself clear. So the data that they are providing you, is that in the same format? In other words, could I sit and look at two different universities and compare how they're offering it and where they're offering it?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. The reporting mechanism to us will be standardized. You'll be able to see each university if they've chosen to offer bonuses, and if so, where they've chosen to offer them. What will not be standard is that universities may be choosing to offer bonuses for different reasons.
Can I ask another question?
Yes, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under the foreign influence section, Senate Bill 846, you said that the board has not received any agreements for approval. How is the board, or does the board have the authority to look and determine if they haven't received things that they should be receiving?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we have that authority. I believe the reason we've not received any agreements is the universities have read the room, if you will, and understand that pursuing those agreements aren't something that is being encouraged at this time. So I think what we're seeing is their behavior has been modified as a result of that.
On Senate Bill 266, the General Education Core Course Options, you said that the board approves or it rejects the course list that they're provided. Is there an opportunity for the universities to either work with them in advance, or is there an opportunity for them to come back if something has been rejected for reconsideration?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I would submit that the boards or the universities are working with the board on the front end, because all of this initiated through recommendations made by the faculty. So they have input on the front end on what their recommendations are. And then if the board makes a modification to that, they have the ability during the public comment period. Remember, I mentioned that there was a two-step process. During the public comment period, they have the ability to contact us and communicate, we really think that this is important and here's why. And as I said earlier, the Board of Governors then looks at the public comments to see if there's something that we've missed in the initial proposal. And if there is, you know, we'll make a modification to our recommendation. So we're in that period now in terms of the general education requirement. I would submit that if we'd received comment from the universities, that would be shared with the board. The other thing I would share with you is that each of the Board of Governor meetings, it's not just our Board of Governors. The presidents of each of the institutions are sitting around the table with them, and the chairs of their Board of Trustees are sitting right by their side. So this really is a collaborative process in terms of the Board of Governors has the constitutional authority, but we are working very closely with the institutions themselves.
One last question.
You sure?
Thank you. Yeah, I promise.
You're recognized.
I promise you.
Okay.
Well, I paid attention.
No, I love it. You're very inquisitive. It's great.
On the tuition waivers and exemptions, I want to make sure I understood correctly. The areas that have been selected are based on current needs. Is that because you're limited only to look at current needs and not necessarily future needs?
I'm going to yield this to the Vice Chair who provided that update, if I may.
Yes, thank you. You're recognized, Ms. Sykes.
Thank you. So on the programs of strategic emphasis waiver, those we have followed the guidelines that have been in the statute that we were directed by the legislature to look at. And when we did our review, we do look at enrollment, we look at workforce needs, and we have a very sophisticated formula that kind of ranks the programs based on those two things. But those are really the key areas that we look at. We will probably look again in this coming year because of changes to our programs of strategic emphasis list, just to ensure that the list still aligns with the statute and the requirements from the legislature.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, next we have Representative Hinson. You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. Or that parts of it that I was able to catch. My question is about SB 266, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and thank you for continuing to call it that. 1000.05 is state statute, and state statute can't conflict with state constitution or US constitution. How are you reconciling that conflict?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. One thing I would point out is that in 1005, if you go back and look at when that legislation was implemented, the Board of Governors promulgated a regulation. The Department of Education promulgated their own rule. That was before my time as Chancellor. My predecessor did not collaborate with the Department of Education. They each went their own way. There was litigation surrounding both the rule. Actually, no, there was only litigation around our regulation. And a judge has issued an injunction that has prevented the regulation that the Board of Governors proposed from being implemented. The rule that the Department of Education passed has not been challenged and has been implemented on the Florida College System campuses. The statute itself hasn't been thrown out, but what has been placed on injunction in its pending appeal was the provision of that as we proposed it in a regulation. So we've not acted on that since the court has enjoined it. But the rest of the statute that's not under an injunction still remains to be implemented, and we have a constitutional duty to implement it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Representative Dunkley. You are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Let me go back to the beginning of our slide on slide 3, where we talked about the purpose of our campuses. I was grateful to carry it on the House side, and so I am quite interested in, do you know at this point how many of our colleges have applied for the designation?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. We have not received a request at this time. I believe part of that is because by the time we proposed our regulation and implemented it, the academic year had begun, and while we operate on the fiscal year and the university's appropriations operate on the fiscal year, the academic calendar really drives most of their decisions. I would anticipate we would see that those applications coming in for the upcoming academic year, which would begin in August. So at this point, we've not received anything, but I believe we will be receiving before August.
Thank you.
You have a follow-up?
Another question.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. On slide 13, following up to Rep. Burfield's question. On our gaps that we have in certain areas, our accounting and finance, how is the collaboration happening to increase the enrollment in these areas? How does the board?
Ms. Sykes, you're recognized.
Thank you. So I think that was part of the intent behind this tuition waiver, is that it would encourage students to go into these programs because they would get, you know, essentially once they're in the upper division of the program, they get they take one course, they get the second course waived. And so that was intended to increase enrollment in those programs. And since those programs were established in 2022, I don't know that we have an enrollment trend yet, but we will probably towards the end of this year be able to say how many more students were in the program this year versus last year.
You are recognized for
Thank
a additional
you, Chair.
Question.
So you said that when they're in the upper of their, so would we, do you anticipate it, or could it be considered that we introduce that before, since there is such a gap? And I'm asking as well because my two best friends are CPAs, and so we have a conversation very regularly about the dying, the death of the accounting field. And so would it serve us to kind of introduce it earlier in the process to be able to get students have their mind on moving over into or considering changing, if they're a business major, changing over into the accounting for the benefit of getting those courses free?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So I think that the statute is right now is at 60 hours or upper division courses. And typically when you get into a program, your lower division is going to be your general education requirements, your prerequisites to get in the program. Most of your classes towards your program requirements are going to be at the upper division level. And I think that was part of the intent behind the statute. But of course, students could take those courses earlier if they're further along in their program.
Thank you. Representative Gonzalez-Pittman, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chancellor, for the presentation. I have a question on the diversity, equity, and inclusion. If Senate Bill 266 prohibits the universities from using and expending any state or federal funds, regardless of the source, so many of the RFPs, federal RFPs, require a section on DEI. How are we addressing or allowing our universities to compete for those grants?
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question. What I would begin by saying is if you look at the university grants, I think the devil is in the details. Mm-hmm. So for example, there may be diversity requirements associated with the grant. But the question is, does the grant actually require training which would violate the statute? Or does the training require the compilation of the folks who will be involved in the administration of the grant in the reporting of whether that is diverse or not? The thing I would want to stress and have everyone understand is that the prohibition is specific to what the actions the legislatures have prohibited. That doesn't include everything within the field of diversity. We have a requirement from an EEO perspective on our campuses to identify and report what our diversity is in terms of faculty, staff, and students. So those things continue to operate because while it's a requirement under the heading of diversity, it's not a prohibited act of what is prohibited within the realm of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So the guidance that's been provided to the institutions is to really drill down on what's required. And if it's not a prohibited act, then they're eligible to pursue that. If it is a prohibited act, then that's going to be an issue in terms of them accepting that grant. And then from there, they should identify that. And we've asked for the information on if they are missing out on grants, what are those grants? We'll collect that data, and then we'll make appropriate recommendations after we have it.
Thank you. So you are collecting data right now on how many people are missing out on grants, how many universities are missing out on a grant?
The universities are identifying if they're missing a grant solely because of a diversity, equity, or inclusion requirement.
Thank you.
Representative Cross, you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about the grandparent waiver. So it looks like we have a set number of 350 waivers that are kind of allocated throughout the university systems. What is the process for a student being awarded that? Is there requirements based on income or other pre-assigned requirements? And is that consistent throughout the universities or up to each university to choose that?
You're recognized.
Thank you. So it is, the requirements are in statute and our board regulation, and it is about test scores, that the student has to have a certain number, a minimum test score coming into the university system. They also have to have a high school diploma that's comparable to a Florida high school diploma that would prepare you to enter college. So those are the requirements set forth in the statute, and it's, I think, been a very competitive process at some of our universities. Some of them have had more, as you can see, University of Florida has a lot of demand for the grandparent waiver, so does Florida State University. And so as we look at it in our board office when we allocate the waivers, we start at one, and if certain universities aren't allocating all their waivers, we'll look and see what universities have waiting lists of students that have met the criteria and are eligible, and we will reallocate the waiver based on the waiting list demand.
Representative Esposito, you're recognized for a question. Oh, I'm sorry, Escamani. Yes, sorry.
It's okay. It's great to be in the E category, right, Rep? thank you so much, Chancellor, for taking the time to be with us. I do have a few questions. I'll go through the chairwoman. So for the foreign influence legislation, Senate Bill 846, anecdotally, I've heard concerns from different members of faculty across the state around challenges in hiring of diverse faculty from these countries that are listed of concern, alongside student recruitment and retention as well. And I'm curious to kind of echo a question about data collection. Do we have data trying to better understand how this policy potentially makes us less competitive in attracting high-quality faculty that perhaps their country of origin is China or Iran, but are in no means tied to, you know, the government, but just wish to contribute to our community? I'm curious if you have any insight to that.
You're recognized, Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair, for the recognition, and thank you for the question. I would begin by saying I think there's a slight difference between these two categories, and here's the difference. On the first, the question from Representative Gonzalez-Pittman, if a university has faculty members who have applied for a grant and have been deemed the most appropriate researchers for that grant and been awarded the grant, and then the federal government puts specific strings on the awarding of the grant that would require an action which is prohibited, then that's a clear black and white issue. Mm-hmm. They've made the application, they've been deemed qualified, and now they can't take the grant because of the strings the federal government has placed on it. That's easy to collect. What I would say is different here is that there's a process where these universities can come to the Board of Governors and say, we would like to enter into an agreement. The agreement we would like to enter into is an employment agreement, and these are the faculty members we would like to hire. Nobody's done that yet. And so what I would say is if they come to us with those agreements, then definitely we will track what has been approved and what has been disapproved. But if they haven't even come and asked, I don't know that they can legitimately say that they've not had the opportunity to hire.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up, Chair.
Okay, you're recognized for a follow-up, Representative Escamani.
Thank you, Chair. I'll pivot to Senate Bill 266, but I appreciate that answer to the previous legislation. So, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the BOG. In 2023, I do appreciate the opportunity to do so and share my perspective on some of these policy and rules being made. I'm curious, when it comes to the definition of DEI that the BOG is set to vote for later this month, scholarship programs that are privately funded, for example, or even publicly funded, that are designed to try to help students of different backgrounds be able to apply and get into the institution, whether it's based on gender, race, or religion, are those also impacted by this rule when it goes into effect?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. And I don't have the statute in front of me, but I don't want to come off as not trying to evade your question,
mm-hmm.
because I'm not. What I would recommend you to do is go back and specifically look at the legislation 266, because the legislature specifically exempted programs from being considered as a prohibited expenditure for DEI. And some of those programs would fall into the categories that you had mentioned. So I can say there's not a blanket denial, because there are specific exemptions that were placed in the statute that constitutionally we honor. If it's not a specific exemption and it provides for public funds that are either state or federal that encourage an act that's prohibited in the bill, then that would not be authorized.
Okay.
But there are some that are specifically exempted in the bill that are authorized. So if it's one of those programs will continue to go on. If it's not one of those, it promotes activity that is prohibited, and it is state or federal funding, it would not be permitted.
Okay. Additional question, Chair?
So before I grant you an additional question, I want to remind the committee that the Chancellor's oversight, SB 266, came before this committee last session. We all voted on it, so we all know what is in this bill. So please keep that in mind, that the Chancellor is providing oversight, and we have 10 minutes left, and there are a few more people that also want to ask questions. Okay. So you're recognized.
I'll make this my last question then, Jerome. I appreciate it. And I'm basing my questions on the definition of DEI from the BOG. So, because we didn't define it in Senate Bill 266, and we did not define programs either, if I'm, you know, going back to my memory. And one reason why I asked this question is, you know, yesterday Governor Ron DeSantis during a State of State address announced that he wants to make it easier for our Jewish students to transfer to Florida higher education institutions, which I think is a wonderful intention. But I'm curious, how is that not preferential treatment, which under the DEI ban that the BOG is going to be approving, it says that we cannot promote differential or preferential treatment of individuals on the basis of these different classifications. So I'm just trying to get a better understanding of what is allowed and not allowed. Thank you, Chair.
Chancellor, give that your best shot.
Thank you, Chair, for the recognition, and thank you for the question. What I would say is, if you go back and look at the executive order that was issued at the direction of the governor, it's tied to those students who are fleeing religious persecution. The attorneys from both the Board of Governors and from the Executive Office of the Governor and from the Department of Education have all collaborated in looking at that language to ensure that it is, one, constitutional, and two, complies with the regulations that the Department of Education and the Board of Governors have jointly drafted. So what I would concede is, yes, if it was purely for those students who were Jewish students wishing to transfer into Florida, it would appear to violate the regulation as it's been drafted and is pending approval. But I would refer you to the regulation. It's specific to those who are fleeing religious persecution, which not only includes our Jewish students, but any student that's seeing religious persecution as a result of what we've seen after October 7th.
Thank you, Chancellor. Vice Chair Beltran, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chancellor, for your presentation. I think you touched a little bit on this with Rep. Escamani, but I want to go back to the Foreign Influence Bill, which was 846. I think what I understood you to say is that nobody's applied for and to do any sort of program or agreement that might come within the bounds of that and asked for board approval. I guess my question is, I just want to confirm that that's the case, and were there any relationships that you all have identified that may violate this law? I'm not sure if you all can go back and require a university to terminate a pre-existing relationship. There's no specific authority in the bill. It kind of looks like it's prospective, and you can't go back and terminate those relationships. That may be the case, but has the board identified any relationships violating that? If so, do you think they have the authority, and in fact, have they terminated any relationships on account of this bill, or has anything not been approved? Thank you.
Chancellor, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, for the recognition, and thank you, Representative Beltran, for the question. What I would begin by saying is, I believe in your question, you've articulated how we're interpreting the statute and that it is prospective. I don't believe we have the statutory authorization to go back and address existing agreements. I think in order for that to be done, the legislature would have to specifically put that in the statute. So we've not reviewed existing agreements. All of those agreements are contractual and will expire at some point. So if the university wishes to continue relationships with these foreign countries of concerns, they have to come to the Board of Governors under the regulation driven by the statute that you passed in order for us to consider that. What we've seen currently is that no one has brought us an agreement and said we wish to either initiate a new relationship, either a partnership or an agreement, or accept a gift, because that's also included in the statute. Nobody has brought, in terms of institutions, a request to the Board of Governors to do any of that yet.
Thanks for your answer. Appreciate it.
Okay, Representative Dunkley, you're recognized for one question. We're going to start to wrap this up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is in line with Rep. Cross's question on slide 14, where the grandparents waiver. I noticed that their universities are apportioned higher, FSU-UF. Is there any data or anything that you're collecting as to why those are higher over the last two, well, the previous academic and current academic year, why so many students are taking advantage?
Ms. Sykes, you're recognized.
Thank you. So we started this allocation process based on, I think it was looking at enrollment and non-resident enrollment of students, and that's how it initially started in 2022 when we first started the waiver. And then as we've had to reallocate the waiver based on the how it worked in 2022-23, we reallocated the allocations for this current year based on the demand that we saw the prior year. And again, I'm not sure as to why we have a lot of, I think we just have a lot of non-residents wanting to come to FSU and in UF and to participate in the program.
Okay, Representative Redmond, you have the final floor. You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chancellor, this is really more of a comment rather than a question. I just wanted to sincerely thank you for your presentation today, particularly as it pertains to the Military Combat Medics Act and the Narcan law that I call it. You have no way of knowing this, but this is the very first time in my young legislative career where anyone has shown me the physical, tangible results of my labor. And it's very humbling. It's certainly very satisfying. It's a feeling that I hope all my legislators, my legislative friends here, I hope it's a feeling they've either already experienced or that they get to experience. And Madam Chair, thank you for showing me that it's definitely worth it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. And he stole my thunder. I just want to say thank you, Chancellor. Thank you for this presentation's been just incredible. And I have to thank my staff as going into my fourth year. And yes, we're neighbors. We were neighbors in Southwest Florida. And so I've watched your career. I really appreciate this presentation because in starting my fourth year, we often don't know. And I've run some of these bills you mentioned today. Representative Redmond, Representative Dunkley, we've all voted on these bills in the last few years, and I really appreciate this update because we often pass things and we have no idea where they are, what the status is, and where implementation is. And I think it's been great. I think having a lot of new members here as well that are starting their second session, they understand a little more of the process. So thank you both very much for this presentation today.
Thank you, Chair, for the invitation and the opportunity to present the update to you. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank my staff. They do the heavy lifting to actually take the statutes and turn them into regulations that get done. And so they work very hard, and I'm sure they're happy to see the fruits of the labor being received and the fact that you guys are pleased with the work that's being done. Thank you again.
Thank you. Members, thank you all for being so inquisitive. Representative Burfield, please know that you and I are very alike, which is why I teased you about it. This is kind of on point with what I've been trying to do in our committee for the last couple of years, is just to show you all that, yes, legislation is important, but what's happening with it? And this is something that I felt was missing through my tenure here in the House, is getting these updates of what is exactly happening. So thank you all for being so engaged. Again, Escamani, I apologize for calling you Esposito. but there's a lot of stuff happening here in this back row. So members, that concludes today's agenda. Seeing no other business before the subcommittee, Representative Escamani moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.